history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you. Seemingly ordinary Americans with extraordinary stories to tell if we're just willing to take a little time to listen. And that's what we try to do here each week. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn so much. We're educated, we are entertained, and often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I certainly hope that's going to be the case today as we approach things a little differently than usual. Instead of just one veteran's life story today, we're going to hear from a few voices that I hope will add depth to the history of one of World War II's most unique and most decorated units. If you've ever cruised through the archives at hometownheroesradio.com, you've seen that there are hundreds of interviews there. And one of the ways I hope to make those podcasts more user-friendly is to organize them by number. Today's show is our 442nd episode, and every time I looked at that, the same thought kept coming into my head. 15 or 20 years ago, the number 442 might not have meant that much to me. In fact, my first thought probably would have been the old Oldsmobile muscle car from the 60s and 70s. But hear that number 442 now, after all these years of meeting hometown heroes all over America, and there's only one thing I can think of. The men who were part of the 442. That's how they often refer to it. The 442, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, which, based on its size and length of service, was the most decorated unit in American history. Maybe you remember the motto, "Go for Broke," celebrated in books and film. And if you ever have the chance, I hope you'll visit the Go for Broke National Education Center in Los Angeles, which has done a remarkable job in preserving the history of the 442 and all Japanese American veterans. The bottom line is the men of the 442 risked their lives, and in so many cases gave their lives, for a country that at one point wouldn't even let them serve, a country that was holding so many of their families prisoner solely on the basis of their Japanese ancestry. Before we jump into some of their firsthand accounts, let me give you some big picture background. In just over 2 years of combat, the 442nd was awarded 8 presidential unit citations, including an unbelievable 5 in just 1 month. The regimental strength was a little under 4,000, but in that short time, the unit had to be replaced more than 2 times over because of casualties. A total of about 14,000 Japanese Americans ended up being part of the 442, and the number of Purple Hearts awarded, again in just a 2-year span, more than 9,000. There were 560 Silver Stars awarded to members of the 442, 52 Distinguished Service Crosses, and eventually 21 recipients of the most prestigious decoration, the Medal of Honor. 10 of those were killed in action in World War II, including the first one, Sadao Munemori, a 22-year-old private from Southern California who had joined the Army before the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. When he woke up in Seravezza, Italy on April 5, 1945, he knew his parents and siblings were still incarcerated at the Manzanar internment camp in California. He had already participated in the rescue of the Lost Battalion the previous fall. More on that event later. For now, I'll let his Medal of Honor citation tell the rest of his story. When his unit was pinned down by grazing fire from the enemy's strong mountain defense and command of the squad devolved on him with the wounding of its regular leader, he made frontal one-man attacks through direct fire and knocked out 2 machine guns with grenades. Withdrawing under murderous fire and showers of grenades from other enemy emplacements, he had nearly reached a shell crater occupied by 2 of his men when an unexploded grenade bounced on his helmet and rolled toward his helpless comrades. He arose into the withering fire, dived for the missile, and smothered its blast with his body. By his swift, supremely heroic action, PFC Munemori saved 2 of his men at the cost of his own life and did much to clear the path for his company's victorious advance. Clearly, Sadao Munemori exemplified the go-for-broke mentality of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. He never had the chance to tell his story, but we've been able to meet some veterans from the 442 on Hometown Heroes over the years, and we're going to listen to some of their stories throughout the rest of today's program, starting with Robert Yano of Kingsburg, California, who appeared on this program shortly after all Japanese-American World War II veterans were honored with the Congressional Gold Medal. He took us back to the day the world changed, December 7th, 1941. He was playing a basketball game when he found out what had happened at Pearl Harbor.
I was playing with the Japanese-American basketball, you might say, club team that we had.
Oh, okay.
It belonged in Parlor, which they call Young Men's Club.
Mm-hmm.
And all of us had different teams in that area. And that particular day, we were down in Lindsay playing a game. And that's where we picked up the story that Pearl Harbor, and we came back to Parlor, and we were just shocked. We all gathered around and talked about it. And then, of course, we all went our way and went home. But that's where it was kind of a shock when we really heard about it.
Did you sense things starting to change after that day in terms of Kingsburg and the surrounding area?
I think it started to show. It started to show. You had the feeling, and you could just have the feeling. I mean, just something, you know, the feeling of other people. Maybe they thought maybe we had something to do with it. I don't know, but it just... You can feel it. I felt it.
And you hadn't finished high school yet.
No.
But along in February the next year, along comes Executive Order 9066, and President Roosevelt declares that you, somebody who was born here in the United States, that you're an enemy alien and that you have to go to a relocation camp. I can't imagine what that must have felt like. And how did you deal with that?
Well, you know, at senior at high school, you know, it was the law that you had to register for the draft, and I just turned 18, and of course that's what I did. So within a week or so, I got a notice from the local board 124 in Fresno. It classified me as 1A, which was eligible for draft,
mm-hmm.
which is fine with me. That was what we had to do. But when they took us out and sent me to Arizona, to the camp, well then it was just a week or so after, then I got a notification saying I was reclassified. I opened it up and says I was 4Cs. Well, that 4C is enemy alien. You know, that's hard to believe that I became an enemy alien. And I talked to my dad, and my dad had one thing over me. He's an alien, but he had a green card, and I was a alien without anything. So it was kind of a dad kind of laughed. We kind of chuckled about it. He told me, he says, "Well, you're an alien." He says, "I got a green card." And he says, "Well, I know you got one up on me there."
And you brought something with you today that originated from your time there at the Gila River internment camp. It's got all kinds of little red dots on it. It looks like some faded fabric. What's it called, and what's the story behind it?
The story is, this is what you call in Japanese a sending buddy. Sending buddy means thousand dots on here. Each dot is put by a lady.
Uh-huh.
And if you wear this around your waist, never take it off, that you'll survive the war and come back.
Mm-hmm.
So while I was in Gila camp, before I was going overseas, a lady came up to me and says, "I want you to have this. I want you to wear it. Take it. So I know that your mom isn't here." So I had all these ladies put these dots on for me. I don't know what if you knew anything about it, but I heard about it before through Japanese culture.
Sure.
That this is what they wore, the soldiers wore, before they went to the war. They wore it around their waist, never take it off. And I did. And I took it, and I wore it around my waist, and it's unbelievable, but it was around my waist. You couldn't tell whether it was white, blue, black, or what. But when I got out after, I brought it home. At the time after I got married, I showed my wife, and she says, "What's that?" So I had to explain. She knew what it was about. But she says, "Well, can't wash it, because if you wash it with real hard soap, it'll take out the dot." So I says, mm-hmm. "Okay." She says, "You just wash clear, cold water, and this is what remained. It's still intact as far as the dots are concerned."
That's impressive. I've never seen one of those before. And what does it mean to you now when you see it, when you haven't seen it for a while and your eyes happen to catch it? What does it remind you of? What does it make you think of?
Well, it reminds me of camp. The most regret I have now, after all that, is not remembering that lady that gave it to me.
Mm.
And I know she meant it from the bottom of her heart, because I'm sure she had kids of her own too, but she brought it to me thinking that, well, this would bring me home. I still take it with me wherever I go and show people this is what it is. And I take it to all the schools, and they're probably in the high school, they're kind of awe because they just can't believe it. Something like this, you know, has gone, you know, on. You know.
Mm-hmm. That was with you in the Vosges Mountains and everywhere you were with the 442nd.
All the way, all the way over and all the way back, up in the mountains, down the mountains, wherever. Yeah.
But so far, you're still in the camp. How did you end up in the military? After you're classified 1A, they change it to 4C. You're stuck there in the camp. How'd you get out?
Well, they opened up and then start opening the draft and whatnot. And this is where I signed up and decided, well, this is, I guess this is my part to go, because I was expecting that anyway, you know. And I felt that this is something that I have to do.
Even though you knew that other members of your family would still be stuck there in the camp, you're going to go fight for a government that's doing that to your family.
Yeah, it didn't bother me. I just felt that this is part of it. That probably maybe this will show that, you know, this is that we are loyal Americans. And one thing I could say, my dad never said it. He just said that you do what you're supposed to do. You were born here. You do what you're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And that's it.
Did you understand that you'd be serving in a segregated unit?
Yes. Yes, I knew that.
Was that a good thing, do you think? I mean, did that help to know that the guys around you were in the same boat as you?
Well, I mean, never even gave it a thought about that. I just figured that I was going to be in the U.S. Army, and that's it.
So here you are, a 19-year-old BAR man, Browning Automatic Rifle, with the Go for Broke unit, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. Your dad was in the Gila River internment camp, but tell us about what happened to your mother.
My mother went back in July of 41.
Mm-hmm.
The two sisters, Auntie and my mom, went back for a visit. And so they were there, and then they were returning back to the United States. The boat came back to Seattle Way. Halfway, they turned around and went back.
Mm.
And so from the story that we received later on is that my mother got sick, and she had an operation, and they thought it was appendix. It wasn't appendix. It was, I don't know what you'd call it in English, but your intestines, they twist and they do something. Anyway, she passed away there. So.
But you didn't know this at the time.
I didn't know at the time. I was overseas then, and none of us knew. It was probably a year or two later, through the Red Cross, my dad and my brother got the information that she had passed away there. That was the only communication we had. So after the war was over, then I decided that Mom was still there. I didn't know that she was gone. So I says, well, I'll hook up again, and maybe I can go to the Pacific and go to Japan. Well, in the meantime, my dad and my brother says, well, you come on home. They didn't want to tell me. They says, you come on home first before you go. And so this is what I did. And when I got home, they says, no, there's no use going. Mom has passed away. And then they explained to me how she passed away and everything. But that was pretty hard.
Wow. That makes it even more unimaginable for me to put myself in your shoes, knowing that your dad is in a camp. You don't even know where your mom is.
Yeah, correct.
Maybe in a country that your own country is bombing.
Correct.
But here you are out there fighting with all these other Japanese American in a unit that say whatever you want about it. Every superlative you can attach to the 442nd has been attached. The Gopher Broke unit, the most decorated unit of World War II. So many casualties. And you're one of the fortunate ones. You were never wounded during the war.
No, I didn't.
You must be pretty shifty. You must be able to
avoid. Well, I'll tell you, I had a big log over my hole every time I dug in.
It's well documented, the extreme casualties suffered by your unit, the 442nd in World War II. What would you say was your closest call, the time where you thought for sure this was going to be it for you?
Well, I think this was for one of my squad men right behind me. He was dug in, and he got hit, and it was just, well, he just got hit, and he's blown apart. I mean, you couldn't find anything, so they had to pick him up by pieces. And another fellow right behind me, dug in. He got hit behind, but he didn't. He survived, but he got a shrapnel, real serious shrapnel wound.
So many were wounded, so many killed. And in the end, the valor of the 442 and other Japanese Americans serving in the war had a great impact. The effects sometimes are still unfolding all these years later. But what would you say that you guys proved?
Maybe we proved we're good Americans.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I always proved that I'm a good American.
Amen. What about the significance of that slogan, go for broke? When you think about go for broke, what does that mean to you? And what did it mean to you then?
It means go all out, all out, all you can do.
And why was that the mentality?
I don't know. Just
because you had nothing to lose?
Go for broke. Don't lose.
Your families are already held captive.
Yeah.
I mean, what else are they going to do to them, right? You got to prove it somehow. And there was something from your Japanese culture, a word in Japanese that you'd heard spoken around the home that kind of became your mantra for the war. What was that?
It's gaman. Gaman.
And what does that mean?
That means you just have to take it. Whether mm-hmm. you like it or not, you just take it. Gaman. You just.
And it becomes kind of a test of your will and your character, how much you can take.
That's right. You can take a lot. Human body can take a lot.
I bet you didn't plan on taking as much as you did.
No, but it's a necessity, you might say, sometimes.
So that was Robert Yano. You can access his complete interview at hometownheroesradio.com. Look for episode number 186. Today is episode number 442, and we'll continue with our tribute to the 442nd Regimental Combat Team with the unit's most legendary feat, the rescue of the Lost Battalion, when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.